Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number in the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Martin, that's a great introduction. We appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, as promised, we have the lead investigator for the late Tony Davis, Mr. Johnny Ringo, who's going to be sharing with us tonight the class that he has been running through for the past few weeks, every other week. And he's also got a special little tale to tell you, something that happened I think it was today or yesterday. So without further ado, well, where did he go? Oh, there he is. I got to change something for him. Okay, go ahead, Johnny. Welcome to the call.
Okay, thank you, Michael. We're going to have a little review of Title 18, which is strictly federal. It has absolutely nothing to do with the state. And all the documents presented here are for information only. No legal advice is to be implied at all. While suggestions are made, it is up to the individual to make his or her decision on how to proceed with their predicament. And upon that, little history on Title 18. If a different bill passes the U.S. House of Representatives than the Senate, the bill is void and no legal effect. First of all, until the Senate and the House pass the exact same bill, word for word, quotation for quotation, and the bill is signed by the President, or the bill is not signed and becomes law without signature because both houses pass the bill, there is no law. Just because the House of Representatives voted to pass a law does not make it an enforceable law without passage from the Senate as well. So all you had is a bill passed by the House in 1947 and a different one passed by the Senate in 1948. Then they have to get together and negotiate a combined or compromise law for passage of both houses before it becomes law or the law dies. Little history. The Federal Criminal Code Title 18 was enacted and codified in 1900. The statute has never been repealed. However, it cannot be used to imprison anyone because that would be a violation of the Fair Warning Doctrine. A recodification of the criminal code was enacted by Congress in 1940. That statute was repealed in 1948 and is no longer law. Another recodification of Title 18, the Criminal Code, was presented as House Resolution H.R. 3190 in 1948. The House representatives voted on the bill on May 12, 1947. The vote was 38-6 to pass the bill. However, there were 435 members in the House in 1948. A quorum, which is required, would have required 218 members. The quorum clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1, was violated, and the bill was legally void at that time. Ignoring the quorum violation, the House sent H.R. 3190 to the Senate. The Senate amended the bill in the second session and sent it back to the House for approval. The House approved the amendments, but never voted on the amended bill. Congress adjourned, signed in the second session on June 20, 1948, and was dispersed and was not in session. The Speaker of the House and President Pro Tem of the Senate signed the bill on June 22 and 23, 1948, while Congress was not in open session. The bill signed was a bill amended and passed by the Senate, but not by the House. The President, Truman, signed the bill amended and passed by the Senate, but never passed by the House on June 25, 1948, at 12:23 p.m. See Presidential Library of President Truman, Daily Calendar. To become law, the President must sign a bill that is passed identically in both houses. Thus, the bill used to imprison American citizens since 1948 is not a law, and its use constitutes fraud and obstruction of justice by any prosecutor and any federal judge which relies on it to take away a citizen's rights. Approximately 7.7 million people have been placed in federal prison since 1948, all without a law. 18 U.S.C. 4001 states that no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained without an act of Congress. Currently, 190,000 people are in federal prisons. Approximately 10% of the prisoners are citizens from other countries. The United States has approximately 3% of the world's population, but approximately 50% of the world's prisoners. In summary, no law has existed since 1948 to prosecute and imprison U.S. citizens. Now I've got a multitude of documents from all over Washington. This one is from the Office of the Clerk, the U.S. House of Representatives. After conducting a thorough examination of the journals, I found no entry in the journal of the House of any May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 3190, also known as Title 18, although pages 343 to 344 of the Journal of the House of Representatives from the first session of the 80th Congress indicates that the bill was amended, purportedly passed, and transmitted to the Senate for concurrence. The Senate took no action on H.R. 3190 bill prior to December 19, 1947, when he adjourned. Page 5049 of the Congressional Record, 80th Congress, first session, indicates 44 members voting 38-6 to amend H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947. Therefore, by counting the total yeas and nays vote, a quorum was not present. According to the House rules, when less than a majority of a quorum votes to pass a bill, the journal must show the names of members present but not voting. I found no such record of any names on the May 12, 1947 vote. I hope this information answers your question. Sincerely yours, Karen L. Haas, Clerk, United States House of Representatives. Another one. Thank you for your recent letter requesting the distribution and stamps of H.R. 3190, House of the Congress. I asked the Senate Historian Office to review the correspondence you enclosed, and they were able to verify that no section was taken by the Senate on H.R. 3190 prior to December 19, 1947. I've enclosed pages from the House Journal and the Congressional Record for your references. This comes from Nancy Erickson, Secretary of the United States Senate. This was dated March 9, 2009. Another response. In response to your inquiry, Congress was in session on June 1st, 3rd, 4th, 7th to the 12th, and 14th to the 19th, 1948. However, Title 18 was not voted on at this time. As you know, Title 18 covers 845 pages in the U.S. Code, and this wording was developed over many years. Signed copies of the law are archived at the National Archives and Records Administration and are not available to the public. I've had 9 trips to Washington, D.C. I've researched the Library of Congress and the National Archives on my own information. I've went through several journals, and I found exact documentation to these documents. Here's another one. According to the House Journal, the House Concurrent Resolution number 219 was signed by the House on June 19, 1948 and passed by the Senate without amendment. The names of those House members who agreed to H9219 were not entered in the House Journal. Their names were never entered. The House Journal and the Congressional Record of June 10, 1948 states that H.R. 219 was signed by unanimous consent, but it does not state whether a quorum was present. It was not. 219 was sent to President Truman for his approval or disapproval. Yes, the Speaker of the House did sign H.R. 3190 in the absence of a quorum, which is a federal violation of the law. Attached is a copy of pages 771 to 772 of the House Journal and pages 9348 from the Congressional Record of June 19, 1948. We hope this provided information has answered your question. They keep confirming that none of this was ever, ever passed correctly. Here is one from the Office of the Clerk in the U.S. House of Representatives. Our office has conducted research on the House Journal and the Congressional Record in regards to H.R. 3190 and the voice vote that was taken on May 12, 1947. After researching these official proceedings of the U.S. House of Representatives, we have been unable to find the names of the 44 members, who responded to the voice vote. We have included pages from the House Journal and the Congressional Record that show the proceedings of the day as far as the quorum is concerned, which was never reached. The text of H.R. 3190 passed on May 12, 1940. It was debated, engrossed, and the motion was laid on the table. H.R. 3190 was passed by the House of Representatives on June 1948 and become public law on June 25th. The House convened on December 1947 for daily business, and the start of the new session of Congress was January 6th. Conflicting dates all the way through. This is another one from Karen L. Haas. This is more or less a conclusion. There was no quorum present due to business during the vote on the bill H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947. As evidenced by the congressional record, and this fact has been admitted to by several clerks of the House of Representatives and the former director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. 1947 vote was only a vote on the entire bill, H.R. 3190, by the House of Representatives. The enactment of H.R. 3190 did not follow the constitutional mandate of Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1 of the Constitution, as there was no quorum present to do business when the House of Representatives voted on H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947, as evidenced by the congressional record in House journals. Several times in the last 22 years that I've been researching this, it's consistently come up that this bill was never legally passed. Here's another one. Curiously, in the same volume, two pages before the one at right, it was stated that Title 18 was enacted in positive law by an act of Congress on June 25, 1948. However, the House clerk, Jeff Trudeau, wrote in a letter to Charles Deegan, dated June 25, 2000, that Congress was not in session on June 25, 1948. The session ended June 19, 1948. And that is one of the stipulations, that both houses must be in session when the president signs the bill, of which they were not. It never passed the House. The complete bill that was passed by Congress was never passed by the House, as there was no quorum. And also, the president illegally, Truman, signed a bill when neither House was in session. So there is absolutely no conflicting evidence that this bill even exists. And yet, they keep prosecuting individuals on this statute. Now, a year and a half ago, there was an interoffice memorandum issued to the federal courts in the various districts that Title 18 was not to be used as a prosecuting statute on individuals. Well, evidently, it got lost someplace, or they just plain decided to ignore it, because individuals are still being prosecuted under Title 18. As I'll give you a little information as what to happen in a yesterday. This is a letter from United States Attorney General Eric F. Holder. The Supreme Court has often acknowledged the appropriateness of reliance on the political branches, policy choices, and judgments. While duly recognizing the court's authority to engage in judicial review, the executive branch has often urged courts to respect the legislative judgments of Congress. At that time, Mr. Holder suggested that Title 18 could only be changed, that the courts should not involve themselves in the direction Title 18 should be judged. He indicated that that should be left up entirely to Congress, and the courts should wash their hands of it entirely. Now, this was an internal memorandum from Eric H. Holder, and this was of April 5th, 2012. So this has been an ongoing conflict within the judicial system. They know it's an illegal statute, and they have failed to rectify anything by going to Congress and saying something has got to be changed. This is wrong. But nobody wants to stick their neck out. I had an interview with, I believe it was 28 congressmen and representatives about a year on this exact subject, because a representative from New York, one of his family members, was being charged on Title 18, and he requested that I give a speech or presentation to several senators and representatives on this exact same subject. I have done so with all of the documentation I've got, some of which I've just presented. And they all agreed at that time that something should be done. Now, this has been about a year and 4 months ago. And to date, nothing has been done. They sure talk a good speech, but they're all afraid of doing anything constructive, in my estimation. They're totally afraid of it. For 20 years, I've tried my damnedest to convince judges and prosecuting attorneys that the law that they're prosecuting people under is non-existent. It does not exist. I've been met with an immense resistance to it. I've been escorted out of the courtroom. I've had a restraining order, an illegal restraining order, issued against me, of which I totally disregarded. But in the last 6 weeks, I have more or less come up with another solution. And it has worked in, as to date, two federal cases. What happened is about 3 years ago, I was involved in a civil case in the county that I reside in. and it was just, it was a state case. And I issued a quo warranto against the judge and the prosecuting attorney, of which they have to have 20 days to respond. Well, what a quo warranto is a document that requires, that is required to give to anybody that requests it proper credentials. And at the time, the judge was William Cussell. He just totally sloughed it off. He says, I don't have to do it. He says, and neither does the prosecuting attorney do it. I says, it's federal law and state law. You've got to issue your documents to anybody that requesting them who you're prosecuting. And he wanted to know. And I says, this is just a matter of record. And he wanted to know if I was an attorney. I says, no, I'm not. I said, but I've been studying law for 22 years. I've got several documents from various universities stating that I've studied law. It doesn't do very much good. All you do is support the colleges because they do not instruct you in the procedures of law. This quo warranto is a document. I believe, just a minute. I believe it's 14 pages long. And in there it states that they've got 20 days to respond to the request for their documents that entitle them to either sit on the judge on the bench or sit across from you and condemn you. These credentials are proper for the judge or administrating magistrate. I correct myself because there hasn't been a judge in this country since 1783. The proper credentials for an administrative magistrate is proper prudential credentials. It's documents stating that the president has appointed him to the bench. A proper OPI form 64, which is required by both state and federal to be issued. A proper oath of office, 28 U.S.C. 2854. And proper Senate confirmation. That being for a judge, it would be a state Senate, or for a federal, it would be a federal confirmation from the states, from the federal Senate. For the prosecution, that's the clown sitting next to you trying to send you to jail, is an appointment of affidavit, 5 U.S.C. 331, an oath of office, 28 U.S.C. 544, an appointment letter delegating the power to prosecute. Now, through thorough investigation of a multitude of magistrates, I find that approximately 93% of those that like to sit on that high bench or next to you and condemn you do not, I repeat, do not have any of this documentation on file. They fail to fill it out. They think they are quote unquote God Almighty and they can do what they damn well please. Well, I filed a complaint with the board, with the legal board of my state, And it took 3 years of prodding and pushing to bring this William Cussell to court. And finally, last week it came to be. I presented the documentations of this quo warranto to the board and asked them that the judge, or magistrate rather, excuse me, furnish these documents to me at the time of my so-called trial. And he was unable to. And he was unable to present it to the Board of Review, the Judicial Board of Review of my state. And he stood there and he says, I don't have to furnish any of these documents to anyone. And he was reprimanded and says that he must upon request. And then was asked, are these documents on file? And he refused to answer. He says, on grounds of it would incriminate him. Well, the Board of Review, after a lot of consoling or consorting, whatever you want to call it, and on my prodding of them for a verdict, to my delight, they removed this clown from the bench in violation of state law. And then I brought it up. I says, okay, now this individual here, if you want to call him that, has been removed from the bench. Now, he's been on the bench for 8 years, a state judge. Or magistrate, excuse me again. And what about all of the people that he convicted and sent to incarceration? Because if he does not have any of these documents on file, he is not qualified or legally able to make the determination for the individuals. And it got very, very quiet. And they says, well, this is something that the Board of Review will look into. I says, you don't have to. I says, I've got over 1,000 documents from individuals that were prosecuted in this room. I says, and what's this Board of Review going to do about it? I says, none of this was legal. And they said, all they said is, we have got to take this under consideration. I says, well, you better, because I'm going to keep pushing the subject. And on the way out of the review room, Mr. Cussell come up beside me, and he says, I'll get you for this. And my response is, many men have tried, a lot better men than you. And anything you want to bring on, I more than welcome it. Because there's several individuals that were fairly well trained by the federal government that failed to, how can they say that? Convince or convene to attain their mission. They were fairly well decimated. So, that was one victory. The other victory happened yesterday. I was brought up I was hired by a law firm to give testimony in a case, in a federal case, with a Judge McCormick. And I went up and I presented the case, and the judge says, are you qualified to practice law? I says, it all depends upon what you want for classifications. I says, I'm not practicing law. I says, I'm giving information to these individuals on a statute. I says, I did not mention any names. I says, it's just information that the defense has requested. And he says, I suppose all these members in this courtroom are members of your entourage. I says, it's only about a third of them. I says, and he says, well, I haven't seen this much leather since I visited the stockyard years ago. I says, well, I says, they're very interested in federal outcomes on this Title 18. So he dismissed the did not dismiss the case. We went into his chambers, and he says, what is your course of action? I says, course of action is only to inform the people of the statute that it's not legal. And he says, well, your entourage out there, is that a form of intimidation? And I says, well, I says, the federal government has been intimidating people for the last 300 years. It started out with the Indian tribes trying to overwhelm them. I says, and now, anytime, to my knowledge, anyone is detained by the federal marshals, it's not one or two, it's 30 or 40 of them. I says, so I more or less hired these individuals out here to be a bodyguard. And he says, well, he says, you know, I can call in the federal marshals. I says, that's your prerogative. I says, but look out your window. I says, there's only so many federal marshals in this state, and if they would all choose to attend your call, I says, we would have them outnumbered at 7-1. And he says, well, how do you know that? I says, I can give you the names and addresses. I says, and if necessary, most of their dental records. And he kind of glared at me, and he says, well, how do you know that? I says, well, I learned a long time ago that if you were prepared for one to give you trouble, you would be no trouble whatsoever. I says, it's all in the process of being prepared and intimidating. I says, that's something the courts have done and the federal government has done for hundreds of years. And I asked him, I says, while we are here, I says, I was involved in a state case. And I gave him the name of the judge. I says, and he was removed from the bench for lack of having the correct documentation on file. I says, a quo warranto was issued. I says, and the law firm that I've been retained by, I believe, has done so, but has not received any response back in regards to you. And he says, are you threatening me? I says, no. I says, I don't have to threaten anyone. I says, when you've got written documentation behind you and requirements required for individuals, if it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. And he looked at me, and then I says, just a question. I says, do you have these documents on file? And he says, that'll be enough of this. He went out in the courtroom, convened the courtroom, looked at the complaint form. He looked at the prosecuting attorney. He says, we'll have to dismiss this case. He says, due to complications in the statutes. The prosecuting attorney damn near fell off the chair. He stood up and he looked at him. He says, I object. He says, you can object all day long. He says, this case is dismissed. So I went out. I retrieved my entourage and several individuals on the outside of the building, and we come home. And I consider that a small victory, of which I've been involved in two of them. Now, I do not recommend this for anybody, unless you've got the resources. And although I'm not a big fan for when cases arise that both defense and prosecuting attorneys refer to different cases in order to set precedent in their cases at hand. While in my opinion, no two cases are identical. Example, the Mendez brothers. The way attorneys try to persuade their way of thinking is completely bogus or wrong. 95% of the attorneys are incapable or unable to accurately form a defense for the poor sap that they're supposed to be representing. While all courts use intimidation or scare tactics, I have come up with the process of reversing that process or train of thought. That more or less concludes my presentation. I thank you for your attention, and I'll turn it back over to Michael.
Well, thank you very much, sir. That was an awesome presentation. Ladies and gentlemen, what you've just heard is your remedy is in the law. And I keep that's the name of the primary website that Bernie's website is under, and GW's website is under, and so forth, John's. So what we have here tonight is just further testimony on the success and the efforts that are put out for your benefit. And, for example, last night there was a widow. She's 87 years old, 88 years old, and she had a hearing this morning that was supposed to, and we had to hire an actual bar attorney because it was ordered by the court that they would not accept in that court a trustee to a trust that they clearly had to, but there wasn't enough time to argue it, and they were going to slam her for summary judgment for home foreclosure. We were up. John, who had two things to write to enter into the court, one judicial notice and the other one a motion for elongation of time, extension of time, was up all night with it, and he and I went back and forth all night with it. I was able to get to bed about 4 a.m. this morning and didn't have to get up until about 7:30, so I had a lot more rest than he did. The point that I'm saying about this is that whatever it takes, the team will do whatever it takes to get whatever is needed done. That's just the way it is. The attorney that was hired, and the reason why everything blew up so quick and we had to do this, it's not because of poor planning. It was because the attorney notified their client, the widow, that this morning, or yesterday morning, that he was not going to appear, which was yesterday morning for her, but it was near almost afternoon for us. So when you have someone like Johnny Ringo here who has the investigative tools to get to the root of the matter, to find the authenticated evidence that needs to move forward, or you have people like John that are, he holds his Juris Doctorate in law, as so do as another information provider we have. This team is in place to make it happen for you. When you correct your status, you're taken out of a pool of people that are 99.99% of all Americans who have, through ignorance, not a willful choice, they just don't know the difference, have become property of the United States as franchises of the United States, as United States citizens, when the alternative of being an American national or a Union State citizen is there for just doing a little process. So that one having been said, let's open this up for Q&A. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2, and we'll move forward with that Q&A. While you're thinking about pressing that star 2, I'm going to go over to Freedoms Radio and see if anyone there has already figured out how to ask a question. What you look at is in the center right of your monitor, you'll see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it and type away your comment or question. Outside or underneath is a place to put your name, some other contact information, if you will, and then hit submit. And it will pop up on my end, and I will be more than happy to give voice to your comment or question. If we don't have any questions tonight, and we've got some good people here, there's one that always has a question or has a comment. I think I'll just unmute him anyways and say hello to Kent. Kent's always good for a Q&A. Go ahead, Kent. I'm putting you on the spot.
Hello, Michael. I don't really have a question for you tonight, but I do appreciate you. I do appreciate the information that Johnny gave us.
Yeah, it's awesome. It is awesome.
I mean, we really have to think about. You know, we talked about last night, and I mentioned the fact that, you know, a lot of people that have worked on these issues previously, you know, felt that they could correct these things from within the system by just bringing the truth forth. But here we have another example of, you know, bringing the truth forth alone does not correct the problem. So there has to be other methods taken in order to get this job done. So while correction of the status is one of the issues, we still have some things to figure out about how to do some of these things within that system.
Correct. Thank you, Kent, for those comments. Jennifer, I'll be right with you. The one of the things that I want to bring up and I've always learned, never ask a question if you don't know the answer before you ask the question. But one of the things that investigators find is the interlocutory relationships between the players, the actors, if you would, within that particular litigation. Did the judge and the prosecutor, did they go to the same law school? Did the prosecutor marry the judge's daughter? Were they ever part of the same law firm at one time? Things like that. Johnny, do you have any thoughts on that from your own personal investigations?
No, not really.
All right.
Granted, they all drink at the same bar.
Pardon the pun, or pun intended.
The alcohol consuming. And when I was in Washington, D.C., there's a place called the Constitutional Pub, or Hall, which is a pub. And senators, representatives, they all gather in one spot. And they all talk amongst one another on the different subjects. And it's amazing what a few drinks, when they become involved with a few drinks, how loose they become. And yep. The admissions that comes forth from them. And I did a lot of listening to it. And I tell you, right now, the corruption in Washington is rampant. Just by listening.
The reason why I brought that up is one of John's investigators uncovered the fact that the judge in a case for one of his students and the prosecutor actually it wasn't a prosecutor, it was it's a civil matter, so it was the plaintiff's attorney. They both were at one time members of the same law firm, 20 years before.
Okay.
Then the local country club showed them as being members of the the country club, but on their resumes they showed membership on their websites. So these things, so with that information, he'll blow that case wide open for the student, showing that there's obviously the ineffective assistance of counsel and the patent bias of a judge. So things like that work in your favor, and that's why you have investigations when you need to have investigations. So, Jennifer, what you got on your mind?
I was just wondering if the attorney said they weren't going to show up. Did the lady get to go to the court, and who went with her, and what was the outcome of all your hard overnight work?
Oh, thank you. I got distracted. The judge, she told the judge, and she was sent out to the hallway to call whoever she wanted to, or just think about the fact. The judge said, very firmly, very forcibly, in an angry tone, I want a decision, and I want it today. We're not going to drag this case out any longer. So she told me that, and I said, you go back in there, and you tell the judge that you feel threatened by him, that his tone of voice, his demeanor, just the very look on his face frightened you. He frightened you. And how dare he talk like that so disrespectfully to an 87, 88-year-old woman? And that it's just difficult enough, to have to go through this. And the long and the short of it is that he postponed her court case until February sometime today, which is a Hail Mary pass, and it is when the Heavenly Father intervenes with things like this that you get those decisions, because they were going to take her house today. No ifs, ands, or buts. It was summary judgment time. And this now gives her team time to go in and do some other matters. She patently declared forcefully and angrily that the signature of her late husband that was purported to be on the promissory note was not his signature. And we had her go and pull birthday cards and any canceled checks, any documents, legal or personal otherwise, around the time that the note was originally purportedly to be signed, and by golly, they did not match at all. The capital letters, you know, you can make a letter one way, and you can have another style for cursive to make it another way, and you know, everybody recognizes the different nuances, but they were patently different. You could tell that one starts at the stroke at the top of and comes down to make a letter, and yet the ones that were in this recording grew from the bottom up. They weren't the same. So we're going to have success with that, I believe. No problem. It's just we had a prayer answer today.
What was that document that was forged then? What was that about?
All right. First off, and this goes to the, listen, investigators are crucial to anything that goes on. They're not needed all the time, but when they are needed, they're critical to getting something done. John has a relationship with someone that did some investigation to learn that the party did not have the note. And so he knew that. It was an inside bit of information from somebody at that same bank. And so he knew that. He was confident that they didn't have it. And they've been asking for 2 years, the trustees, first it was PJ and then it was John, as well as the student, asking for the past 2 years for the original note. We have someone who'd like to buy the original note, pay it off. Just provide the original note so that we can examine it, and we'll move on. We'll get rid of this. And for two-plus years, the bank never do it. Now, all of a sudden, they show up with it for summary judgment. All right? Mm. And it wasn't the original note. So, anyways, the judge even made a comment 3 weeks ago at the last hearing 3 weeks ago that he suspects that the one of the lawyers wasn't forthright in their claim of having the note. So it's just how things work out. Anyway.
Mm. Okay, and is Johnny Gringo, can he be involved? I mean, when is it time for me to go after my people, or do I have to pay for a few more years, or the taxes, you know, or,
you're
and also,
yeah.
Huh?
Go ahead, I'm listening.
Oh, and do my deeds have to be recorded, or is it okay if they're not?
Yeah, that's a question for John, particularly, because he has experience on that. Again, I don't know what experience Johnny Ringo has on separating the United States land from a state's of the a Union state's land from the parcel. What's going on right now in your case is that they're all acting like it's owned by the United States. It's United States land, ergo you have to pay a property tax, etc. The owner of a land has the right to tax. So in a union state, clearly you would be the owner of the land, and you could tax a tenant that you may have, and you'd be perfectly within your rights to do that. But the union state is not going to tax you, because the union state recognizes land held in Elodium. The United States will not recognize that. So it's a needle to thread, and John's the one to do it.
Okay.
Michael.
Johnny Ringo, do you have any closing or thoughts on this, Johnny?
Yeah. There's an individual from Oregon, when you're talking about the owning of land. It involves land patents.
Right.
And if you have a land patent on it, you do own your land. If you have a deed or a warranty deed, the state or the federal government owns the land.
Correct.
And this man is, his name is Ron Gibson.
Wait a minute. Yeah, we got. We'll take care of this later, Johnny.
Okay.
As far as identifying the people, et cetera, but we'll take care of that later.
You wrote a book, period.
I know. Right. He's excellent. He's excellent. All right. Anything else? Anyone else? Otherwise, it's Kent. Welcome back, Kent.
So I wanted to ask a question. As long as you mentioned land patents, I understand that one of the problems with some of the people that are working on title and allodium or allodial title and land patents that they're running into is when the land patents were granted, depending somewhat on what state this happened in, it was often for large amounts of acreage. And there's been some problems, again, from what I understand, in separating smaller parcels when you no longer, have acquired the original 200 acres or whatever the land patent was from the king, et cetera.
Right.
Have you heard of anybody?
That issue was resolved by having a surveyor do it the old-fashioned way by way of meets and bounds. And you carve out within, you reference that land patent and then use the surveyor's meets and bounds to carve that piece out so that you don't trespass on anyone else's land.
Okay, and then you're getting a title in allodium, even though it's a lesser amount than what the original land patent was?
Well, you also have to do what's called an abstract of title on that portion of land that takes it back to oftentimes to when a king granted the original land patent. So you have that abstract of title added to it. So it's an involved process. It's not a simple thing. The gentleman that Johnny mentioned is got it down pat. John's got it down pat. I'm aware of how it's done, but I'm not an information provider. I just play
and then
music
I wanna,
and everybody dances.
I want to make one other comment. If we listen carefully to all of the people, the information providers that you present and other people, there's really a, and you may or may not agree with this, and I'd like to hear your comments after I say what I'm going to say. There's a common thread that runs through much of this work and even what Johnny Ringo is doing, and that is you have to be very skilled at asking the right questions. And I have found on a personal basis that if you look at their system and you look at their own laws and you develop the right set of questions, and once they start speaking, they will give you the additional questions you need to put to have them put
you're absolutely
a noose around their own neck. And so the common thread that runs through all of this is learning how to ask the appropriate questions. And a lot of court cases can be stopped. A lot of attorneys will head south and will not be interested, even if they're assigned by the court to represent somebody. They will no longer be interested in doing that. Of their own volition, they will go to the court and ask to be taken off the case and delay the case, you know, for an indeterminate amount of time. So I find that most people that are doing this, that aren't trained in this type of thing, are somewhat inadequate when it comes to asking questions, listening to the answers carefully, and then having them develop the rest of the questions for you. And while it is a good idea to always know the answer to the question before you ask it, a lot of good work can be done even if you don't know the answer if you listen carefully and put it together on the spot. It works very well.
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. There was a gentleman this morning. Last night I heard that he had been arrested yesterday afternoon for he had a taillight that was out in Arizona. There's a saying you go to vacation in Arizona. You go to Arizona for vacation and you leave on probation. That's the saying. And he was pulled over because his taillight was supposedly out. And when the officer came up, he wouldn't give him the fellow behind the wheel wouldn't give him his driver's license. He says, "I'm not driving right now. I'm traveling. I don't have anyone here that is a passenger for hire, and I'm not carrying any cargo for anyone for hire. I'm just traveling." And the officer We got him out of the car and cuffed him and went into his back seat, just started helping himself. And there was his AR-15 in a secured zip bag. And he also had his pistol there as well in its own zip bag in the back seat. Couldn't get to it from where he was behind the wheel. And they also found some things that, well, if you press them right, they have some CBD oil in them. So they got them for, they just ran up federal charges to beat the band. And so we told him, because he went to arraignment this morning, we were able to get a dialogue to establish on the record, you know, his political status and all that when that was associated with it, because none of those charges apply to a Union State citizen. And then the judge got very arrogant, short-tempered on it, and said, this is my court, said, this is my courtroom, I have jurisdiction, I say I have jurisdiction, and I'm remanding you for custody. So he was able to sign out on his own recognizance, didn't even have bond, et cetera. He's bringing the team on to assist him with this. This is the most serious matter. I mean, he could go 20, 30 years on these charges that they've got against him. So.
All over a tailwind.
Yeah. Yeah. He had no probable cause to even pull him over. So. Anyways, it's all good. It's all good.
Well, I had somebody tell me yesterday that's in law enforcement in New York City that, as he sees it, the big problem is that these people that are in law enforcement, whether it's police or working for an agency where they believe they have some kind of enforcement powers, they're all being trained today, with rare exception, to look at the public as being in combat with them, and that everything has to be a war, and they have to overtake the public that's out there. So here we go back to, you know, correcting your status.
Yep. Johnny, do you have any closing words for us tonight?
No, that man is 100% correct. When you go into court or when you have confrontation with any of these clowns that wear a badge, you consider yourself you're at war. And this more or less concludes all my documentation presentation. And I thank you for
All right, one more thing, ladies and gentlemen, and most importantly, we are not going to have a call tomorrow night. We are not going to have a call tomorrow night. So I want to thank everyone for joining us. Until next week, good night. And be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.